The following preview is of a graphic audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Bonsoir.
Good evening.
Monsieur Valois, I am Jacques Lambert. I have been following your research online for months. I have a keen interest in the sword.
Theo?
The sword is not for sale.
I wager you'll hand over the sword for a kidney.
Monsieur Valois, is it you?
Oui, it is real, Anya. The sword has been found.
D'Artagnan's sword.
Are you going to check to see if it is in there?
It's a rolled parchment.
The map to the real treasure.
I'm guessing this map is the labyrinthine aqueducts beneath the city.
Come along, Anya. La vie souterrain.
What an appropriately macabre place for the queen to leave a treasure. Asher, did you hear that? What do you think it was?
Probably just rats.
I don't think so.
You know, I do not like you, Lambert.
Give me the map,
Theo.
Call off your goons, Lambert.
He is expendable.
Kill him!
No!
Anya, leave me. I'm dying.
Hang in there, Asher. You can do this.
I've been expecting you.
Then I'll get you, Lambert. All this is for what?
I've got my eye on a new treasure. It is another sword. A magical one.
You believe in magic?
I know, Anya. I know.
You know nothing.
I will have the sword. Touché.
Rogue Angel 15. Swordsman's Legacy. From Graphic Audio.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Outlanders. Narrated by Terence Aselford. With performances by Thomas Penny, Nanette Savard, Richard Rowan, David Coyne, Lily Beacon, Elizabeth Jernigan, Tim Getman, Peter Stray, Elizabeth Demery, Dylan Lynch, Christopher Graybill, David Elias, Joe Brack, Tony Nam, Jeff Baker, Casey Platt, Jason Stiles, Ren Casey, Tim Carlin, and Mort Shelby. Outlanders number 46, Pantheon of Vengeance. Artemis's flat-treaded, semi-clawed metal foot sank into the hillside with all the ponderous weight of her 3,000-pound clockwork-geared frame. The robot's pace seemed to be leisurely as she topped the small swell in the terrain, but it was just the illusion cast by her towering 15-foot height. Artemis was a decidedly female construct. There was no disguising her feminine breastplate, contrasting with the masculine sculpted copper torsos of her fellow mechanically suited warriors. Her head, a camera-laden module with ruby-red optics placed where the eyes would be in a bronze-forged representation of a woman's face, was set between shoulder-mounted guns. A mane of glimmering golden ribbons of polished and colored steel wool hung like real hair. Diana Pantopoulos, who piloted the 1.5-ton mobile warsuit, was one of the elite. Thus, she had been rewarded with the identity Artemis. A mere combat drone bore a singular red ID number painted onto a coppery simulation of a pectoral muscle. The rank-and-file drone pilots strode into battle with ID stencils, not names drawn from the gods of ancient Greece. The mane of Diana Pantopoulos' suit glimmered like fire in the light of the sunset. Two fat braided ropes of gold-polished cable fell forward down the chest. Though the warsuit pilot called the metals that made up the armor copper and bronze, they weren't. They were far older materials, crafted by beings whom Hera Olympiad had identified as the gods themselves. The specifics really didn't matter to Diana, because inside the robot walker, she was not just another subject of the new Olympian nation-state. She was Artemis, the Artemis of the third millennium. She swiveled her camera head to the left, spying Ares, with his green copper mohawk jutting from forehead to the back of his neck, as sharp and aggressive as a circular saw blade. A glance to the right showed Apollo, his burnished yellow locks a more masculine rendition of her own red-gold wig. The three of them were Hera's representatives of the pantheon known as Strike Force Olympus. The three towered more than twice as tall as a man, and they bristled with cannons and wielded massive manipulator claws that could fold into fists easily capable of crushing a boulder. The god-themed robot warriors had their own weapons, based on their larger-than-life inspirations, while the smaller mechanoids that they led were styled after helmeted Spartan warriors. One forearm was concealed under a buckler 5 feet in diameter, while the other arm ended in a spike-knuckled claw that could fold into a 2-foot-wide monster fist. Artemis looked down into the valley. The commander units and their squadron of Spartan troopers were standing as a copper-colored wall, overseeing a writhing mass that could only be the enemy. The Dark One, Thanatos, did not possess the industrial means to match the mechanized might that shielded New Olympus. But the Hydri hordes below, the warriors of Tartarus, had been produced in clone farms. Despite their primitive technology, they still posed a deadly threat to the Greeks who had striven to rise from the post-apocalyptic barbarism in the shattered island nation. Thanatos's seething legion of black, scale-skinned Hydri glared up as one, like a thousand-handed, thousand-eyed monster. Artemis had seen the clone horde act as if it were under the command of a hive mind. Though armed only with muskets and bayonets, the simplest weapons that Thanatos could produce, they were a fearsome force that threatened to overwhelm the town Strike Force Olympus had sworn to protect. Artemis's pilot clicked on the loudspeaker built into her head unit.
You have only one chance. Turn back, and you will all live.
As one, the Hydri horde surged up the hill, their bare, claw-toed feet digging into the grassy slope. The front line opened up with their muskets, and Artemis's copper-colored breastplate shuddered under the sheet of lead balls. The smooth, polished surface was soon riddled with dozens of pockmarks. Artemis triggered her shoulder-mounted guns. The built-in weapons were belt-fed blasters that fired cartridge ammunition, faster and more powerful rounds than the musket balls, but required more craftsmanship to make. The other mechanized units matched her actions, except for Ares, who deployed his twin thermal axes. The Mohawk war machine leaped across the gulf of 50 yards between the formation of robots and the churning throng of clones, clawed feet crashing into the writhing enemy force. 3,000 pounds of machinery easily crushed a dozen Hydri under the huge four-taloned feet. The force of Ares' impact jarred the hillside loose. A small landslide rushed down the slope, tripping up scores of Hydri as the wave of freed soil cascaded into shins and thighs. While the other warsuits relied on their shoulder-mounted machine guns, Ares preferred a more hands-on approach. His twin double-headed axe blades, heated to 500 degrees Fahrenheit by internal thermal elements, carved through flesh in wide, sweeping strokes that separated torsos and severed limbs all around him. Ares cleared a 15-foot-wide swath in two body-shredding swings of the robot's long arms. Artemis let her shoulder guns fall silent and drew one of her javelins. Like the goddess of the hunt she emulated, the war armor she piloted favored the slender, accurate, explosive spears. A powerful throw launched the warhead-tipped javelin at more than 1,000 feet per second, and though Artemis could easily and accurately toss the spear 2 miles, at the spitting range distance between her and the savage Hydri, it was like shooting a bullet into an anthill. The custom-tipped spear burst through relatively fragile humanoid forms, tearing them to pieces before the internal fuse was finally armed with the right amount of kinetic energy. The gore-spattered missile exploded, sending a deadly storm of shrapnel into a crowd of mutants. To her left, Apollo unleashed the heat of the sun itself. Greek fire consumed a flank of irate clones that had swept around in an attempt to outmaneuver the Guardian war machines. Powdered aerosol-based orichalcum reacted on contact with sunlight and flashed brilliantly, long tongues licking through the scale-skinned hydri and leaving behind only blackened bones. Robot drone troopers lashed out with spike-adorned, 2-foot-wide metal fists, even as their shoulder guns blazed. Artemis turned her head and spotted a swarm of scaled flesh piled over a Spartan fighter into a mound 20 feet high. She watched as a mechanical fist burst through the bodies before being swallowed again by the writhing melee, then triggered her shoulder weaponry. But for every two she knocked aside, four more rose. The Hydri were indeed like their ancient namesake, the Hydra, as they swarmed over the cleared body. The Ares mechanoid looked back at her.
Arty, there are more heading to the town. A second formation is in motion.
I see it, Ares. You and Polly hold the line here. You two, with me!
Diana waved for two of the Spartans to fall behind her as she turned and leapt. Hydraulic leg pistons hurled Diana into the air with enough force to shove her deep into her pilot's couch. The 20-yard bound took her to the top of the hill. The two drone infantry fighters were close on her heels, and together they ran down the far slope of the hill. Gaining momentum, they closed the distance to intercept the maddened clones charging toward the town. The town's militia, armed with pikes and crude muzzle loaders, were braced for the enemy assault. Artemis admired the courage of those she was sworn to protect. The line of human defenders was outnumbered by the savage attackers. Artemis and her soldiers fired with their shoulder guns, perforating the flank of Hydri as they bypassed the mechanized hilltop force. Three pairs of machine guns, however, were not enough to counter the Tartarus hordes. Artemis drew another of her javelins and hurled it into the heart of the group. The detonation of the 70-millimeter warhead devastated the back half of the column of Hydri mutants. Bodies stumbled and tripped over downed brethren.
Fire!
The town's militia opened fire with its own primitive muskets and bolt-action rifles. As the Hydri at the head of the charging remnants fell, with bullets puncturing their organs, the remaining attackers renewed their charge, leaping over black-scaled corpses twisted in the dirt. Diana Artemis reached for another javelin, but the horde was suddenly too close to the skirmish line defending the town. She ground her teeth in frustration as she realized the townsfolk would be caught in the spear's blast radius. Artemis leaped, soaring over the space between herself and the Hydri as the first bayonet sank into a citizen's chest. Anger stirred inside the metal-wrapped warrior's heart. With a feral rage that Ares would have been proud of, Diana Artemis landed on the necks of a half-dozen clones, her four-toed hydraulic leg squashing them into the soil with the force that only a ton and a half of metal could produce. Her backup opened fire, slicing through the stunned and distracted Hydri, ending their vat-borne lives in a hail of bullets. Artemis's throat filled with bile, however, as she saw Greek men and women twist and fall alongside the Hydri.
Fall back! I'll hold the line!
The horde of attackers twisted, eyeing Artemis as she drew her javelin from its hip quiver. They lunged forward, swinging and stabbing with their bayonet-tipped muskets, determined to down an elite mechanoid warrior.
Shit!
Pike-sharp points penetrated her armor, razor-sharp steel coming far too close to Diana's all-too-vulnerable human body in the pilot's compartment. She didn't dare retreat, or the attacking hordes would turn back and fall on the new Olympians racing back to shelter. A jabbing bayonet opened a gash on her cheek. Another needled into her thigh. The strength and fury of the Hydri horde were more than the metal skin of her warsuit could fend off. Artemis stabbed the earth with her javelin. The warhead belched out a sheet of flaming death and flying metal. The concussive shockwave and heat were dampened by the cushioned tub of armor that cradled her pilot seat, and the mobile suit's armor deflected the notched razor wire that had wrapped the explosive core of the javelin's point. Hydri corpses flew off and away from the armored battle suit's massive frame. Dazed by the ground zero detonation, Diana looked down to her hydraulic right arm. The metal sleeve that protected the skeleton's carpal manipulators and ulna framework had peeled back like the petals of a steel flower, but the gears and pistons, composed of secondary orichalcum, had withstood the powerful detonation as if it were nothing more than a stiff breeze. Flinking away the spots dancing before her eyes, Diana glanced up to see the Hydri not only fleeing from her, but retreating from the field of battle entirely, running back whence they came.
Arty! Arty, report!
She took a tentative step, noting that the right leg's mechanisms had been knocked out of alignment. The metal components of her legs were vulnerable to explosive displacement. She needed realignment back at the base.
Artemis to Ares. I'm still standing, Airy. So is the town, but it'll take some extra time to walk home.
Thank Hera.
Artemis glared silently at the two backup units as they stood between the fleeing Hydri and the besieged townspeople. Diana pulled aside her microphone and opened the window on her cockpit.
You two!
The pair took a step closer and their own cockpit windows opened. They both knew what was coming.
You fired on your fellow citizens!
They were overwhelmed. We couldn't rescue them. They were dead anyway.
That is not your call to make!
Diana looked at the tangle of human and mutant bodies. Six Greek men and women lay among the scores of Hydri mutants. Bite marks and bayonet wounds marred faces and chests, but she also saw the ugly puckers of gunshot wounds on the humans.
They trusted us to die for them. Instead, they died because I was too slow and you were too hasty. Remember this in the future.
She turned away from the drones and looked toward Apollo as he approached.
Polly, what's the word?
The Hydri are pulling back. They no longer have any stomach for battle.
Airy?
Broke one of my axes again, but I found something in the mix. You have to come see this.
Bring it back to base. I'm too slow as it is to make the walk worth it. If it's that important, then we have to go show Zu and Her Highness as well.
Ares transmitted his camera image to her screen.
Just look, Artie.
Diana dropped her gaze to the image on her screen. The corpse appeared to be another reptilian variant, similar to the basic Hydri clone. However, where the scaled hordes of Thanatos were naked, bony-limbed, and distorted abominations, this reptilian was tall, strong, and of perfect build. He also wore a second skin that conformed to his muscular frame, glinting in the sunlight like metal.
What the hell is that?
Beats me, but we're bringing the remains back.
Diana Artemis turned to glare at her Spartan units.
Go back with the rest of the main force. I've got some thinking to do.
As Diana, in her war robot, limped back to Strike Force Olympus headquarters alone, she glanced at the stored image of the lifeless, metal-skinned newcomer, trying to cope with the mystery. It took an extra half hour for Artemis to return to base. When she arrived, she backed the war suit into its storage berth. Mechanics swarmed around, looking at punctured and blood-caked steel skin. Ted Fast Euphastus, the head of maintenance for the magnificent machines that had been discovered by the goddess queen of New Olympus, shook his head at her.
Lord, R.D., you fucked the suit up again!
Shut up and just fix it, Ted. Where's my chair, Carmine?
We're bringing it.
Carmine and other repairmen looked at the dented, distorted chest plate.
Damn shame those mutants had to mess up a nice rack like that. We'll get to work on them, have them looking perky again.
Do whatever the hell you want, Carmine.
Diana crawled out of her couch, glaring at the metal, breast-obsessed mechanic. Carmine froze as angry blue eyes gleamed from the half-fused mask of Diana's burned, ruined face.
Do I really look like I give a damn about a pair of robot tits?
Carmine shook his head as Diana unplugged the cybernetic trunk cable from its port at the base of her spine. She swung the metal-capped stumps of her half-thighs out and into the seat of her wheelchair. Slender, ropey arms braced themselves on the wheelchair's armrests, and she lowered herself down. Her gymnast-tight arm muscles stood out as they flexed under the weight of her torso and half-legs. Ted eyed her thigh.
You're bleeding.
Diana looked down at the blood that soaked through the bandage she'd placed on a bayonet injury.
I took care of it while I had Artemis walking on autopilot.
She peeled off her leather helmet, and thin, straw-like hair fell in a wet tangle over her eyes.
Anyway, it's just a scratch, Fast.
Fast's lips quivered with concern, but something drew his attention from the red splotch on her thigh. Diana spun her wheelchair to see what was going on. Hera Olympiad would have been impressive just with her 6-foot-tall, voluptuous body and piercing green eyes. However, clad in a shimmering silver skin that conformed to her athletic body, making her appear like a naked silver statue, she truly was unmistakable as the goddess queen of New Olympus. Only her finely featured face was visible through a window in the otherwise seamless gleaming metal skin. She strode with focus toward Diana in her chair. Diana dipped her head in a bow to the woman who had come to Greece in search of mythic technology. Hera had come from a place called Cobaltville, but had chosen to remain in Greece, using the wonder she'd unearthed to become the defender of the inhabitants of the Shattered Islands. Before Hera's arrival, their problems with barbarian pirate raiders had grown worse with the rise of the Hydri under the command of a madman named Thanatos. With the discovery of the Hephaestian mobile suits, Hera had single-handedly ensured peace and tranquility under the protection of the new Olympians.
Apologies, my queen, for the damage I allowed to Artemis.
No, my child. Metal can be reforged, but our villages cannot be so readily repopulated. Once more, your heroism honors me, Diana.
Smooth metallic fingertips grazed tenderly down the scar tissue that made up the left side of young Diana's face. The goddess queen's touch was cool and soothing to her skin.
Then what brings you here, milady?
Eri has shown me what he showed you. We are facing a demon from my past. I will brief you all, but the creature you discovered was not born in the vats of Tartarus.
From where then, my queen?
Hera looked out of the slowly closing hangar doors, her silvery skin burning bright in the reflected sunset bleeding over the distant line of hills.
The creature was sent from my old home, Cobaltville. My baron had sent me, seeking an advantage over his fellow barons. Now he no longer needs that advantage.
The hangar doors clamped shut, and Hera's chrome flesh no longer shone bright. The shadows of the hangar were reflected in black hollows and voids on her mirrored skin.
The new Olympians must now face a real god, my child. Come with me.
Diana followed her queen, forcefully propelling her wheelchair to match the goddess's long strides. Mohandas Lakesh Singh wondered if he was going to survive the effort it took his 250-year-old body to crawl over the boulder-strewed hillside in the Bitterroot Mountains. Lakesh was pushing his physical limits on this odd little hike, led by Domi, who moved with panther-like sure-footedness ahead of him. At just a hair over 5 feet, Domi looked as if she had been carved out of ivory. Her muscles were tight and firm, and if she were older than 25 years, her smooth, unlined face and near-perfect physical conditioning didn't betray it. She wore cut-off jean shorts and one of Lakesh's khaki safari shirts, which billowed down from her shoulders like a tent. She tied off the tails under her breasts, leaving her toned stomach exposed. Aside from her scant clothing, she also had a small gun belt with her equally small Detonics Combat Master and a waist-level quiver for the lightweight crossbow slung across her slender shoulders. Domi looked back to the exhausted Lakesh. Her face broke into an impish grin.
Need a rest?
Not at all. Though, Domi, dearest, it would have just been easier to tell me where you like to go hunting.
Domi raised a white eyebrow. She then looked at the small sheath of quarrels bouncing against her upper thigh.
Oh, this.
I understand the feral needs.
Before he could finish, she bounded down off the boulder she stood on and planted a kiss on his lips.
You are smart about a lot of things, but my trips aren't just about getting fresh squirrel meat.
Then what is this about?
Some really neat things. It's not far now.
Mystery. Soon to be solved.
Making fun of the way I used to talk?
No, just out of breath.
She gave him a soft pat on the cheek, then tapped his stomach with the back of her hand.
This is the other reason. You need some exercise.
Lakesh, really not having the breath for a retort, contented himself with sticking his tongue out at her. That only made the albino girl grin even more widely, and she gave his abdomen a playful pinch.
Come on!
She held his hand in hers as they resumed their trek. They moved a little more slowly now, letting Lakesh regain his wind as they followed a narrow trail that wound to the mouth of a cave.
Welcome to my archives!
Lakesh's eyes started to adapt to the dimmer illumination inside the cavern. The Cerberus scientist whirled at the sound, wishing he'd brought a firearm for himself when a small gray bolt of fur lunged at him.
Mo, no!
Domi intercepted the flying little fur ball inches from Lakesh's face.
Bad Mo! That's the man you're named after. Be nice.
She held up a small creature with the familiar bandit mask of a raccoon in front of Lakesh's face. A pointed little brown nose wrinkled.
Sniff him. He's friendly.
Lakesh's eyes finally adjusted, and he could see the little gray and black creature, far less menacing in appearance than he expected. Mo touched noses with Lakesh. A moment later, a tiny pink tongue began lapping at Lakesh's cheeks.
He's licking my face.
Hold him for a minute.
Domi handed the animal to him. The raccoon continued to sniff and nuzzle Lakesh as the albino girl walked to where she'd stored a small battery-operated lantern. She clicked it on, and Lakesh looked around the cave, seeing plastic storage shelves and containers, each laden with all forms of odd knick-knacks and faded, though once garish, periodicals and paperbacks. Mo crawled up onto Lakesh's shoulders, but aside from the odd feeling of tiny hands in his graying hair and the softness of fur on his nape, the little beast hadn't so much as scratched him. Lakesh's eyes danced across cracked old figurines, time-worn stuffed animals, and bald plastic dolls sitting at eye level on several shelves.
This looks like a teenage girl's room.
Maybe. That's the first stuff I collected. I might have been a teenager back then.
You come here all the time?
His fingertips ran over a plastic crate filled with a mix of ancient comic books and ratty old magazines.
Sometimes.
Domi pulled a black cartoon mouse off one shelf, inspecting it. She pushed the stuffed animal's eye back into its face, kissed its furred forehead, and put it back on the shelf.
A lot of old toys. The things that would be at a garage sale. Old puzzles, picture books, even old LPs and tapes.
Lakesh wiped dust off an album cover, then his eyes widened.
Blue Oyster Cult. Oh, that takes me way back. We have a lot of this in the computer archives. You don't need to hunt all this down. Why did you?
Way back before I met Grant, I always wanted a room of my own, full of stuff that I owned. In the Outlands, the only thing I had were the clothes I wore.
She picked up a doll that Lakesh had thought was bald, but it was just white-skinned and white-haired, dressed in what appeared to be a hand-sewn version of a shadow suit. Lakesh could see where Domi had trimmed its hair, arms, and legs in proportion to foot-tall doll representations of Kane, Grant, Bridget Baptiste, and even himself. He walked to the familiar-looking dolls set on a rocky shelf.
What are these?
Sort of like a family portrait. The people I love.
Lakesh felt his throat tighten for a moment. Domi was a fiery young woman, quick to anger and voracious as a lover, and Lakesh realized the depth of caring she possessed was evident in the loving detail applied to each of the tiny totems standing together. Each had been carefully sculpted and repainted and painstakingly dressed to be a perfect miniature. Taking a step back, he felt the corner of a container scratch his calf. Lakesh looked down at the box. In large letters on the top of the crate, the word Reed was scrawled in marker. More boxes were beside it, but unmarked, except one with a strip of tape marked to Bridget.
Those are ones I know she hasn't read yet. She gave me a list. When the box gets full, I bring them down to Cerberus for her.
Domi put her miniature self back with the rest of its family. Lakesh saw two versions of himself. The old, withered self, before Enlil as Sam had bestowed the gift of rejuvenation upon him, and one that more closely matched his appearance now. Lakesh admitted, though, that the hook-nosed little doll seemed to be considerably more handsome than he currently felt.
Quite a library, but why not use the archives?
Those aren't my books. This is me and mine, here. My people. The things I've learned. The stuff I think is cute. And Mo.
Lakesh scratched the haunch of the fur ball on his shoulder.
Called Mo because he's so smart.
Domi's eyes widened, lips parting for a moment as she was caught off guard.
Yeah. Smart. Right.
Lakesh mentally flashed back to all the times that Domi had sat in his lap, his fingers giving her shoulder a squeeze or scratching her back. He could easily imagine the situation reversed for Domi and the raccoon. The young albino sitting on the floor of the cavern, Mo curled in her lap as her fingertips absently scratched its back, mirroring her pose whenever Lakesh read to her, teaching her how to read. Domi winced as she noted the mental gears turning in her lover's eyes as he figured out the equation. Lakesh leaned in close to Domi and kissed her tenderly. He never had felt more in love with the feral girl who had grown so much since he'd first met her.
You are truly the sweetest thing to come into my life, darlingest Domi.
Her cheeks turned almost cartoonishly bright red at the statement. With an inevitability that both Lakesh and Domi had grown used to, their comtacts, subdermal transmitters that had been surgically embedded into their mastoid bones, buzzed to life.
Lakesh, Domi, where are you?
Mr. Bry, we're about a 2 hours hike from the redoubt.
2 hours at your speed, or Domi's?
Lakesh rolled his eyes, eliciting a smirk from Domi. Mo simply started grooming his ear.
What's wrong, Mr. Bry?
I picked up something on satellite imagery from over the Mediterranean. The remains of Greece, to be exact. Atmospheric disturbance indicative of...
Anunnaki dropships.
Lakesh's mood soured instantly, and even resting his arm across Domi's suddenly taut shoulders did little to help him. He looked down at the girl who was listening on her own bionic contact.
Send out a sandcat to meet us at Road 6 Marker 12. We'll be there in 15 minutes.
Seemingly recognizing the urgency in his mistress's voice, Mo bounded off Lakesh's shoulder into her arms. Domi gave the raccoon a loving hug and a kiss on the end of its pointed nose.
Be good, Mo.
She set the raccoon down and he scampered out of the cave. Regretting the hike's abrupt end, Lakesh followed Domi out of her personal archive and down the rocky slope of the hill. Kane stood, a silent sentinel at the Cerberus Redoubt's entrance, as the Sandcat rolled up. His cold, gray-blue eyes regarded the modified armor personnel carrier as it slowed to a halt, its side hatch swinging open to allow Lakesh and Domi to exit. But the dour expression darkening his features gave Lakesh momentary pause.
What is it, friend Kane?
They're still alive.
Perhaps. Just because friend Bry saw evidence of a dropship means nothing. Someone else might have come into possession of one of their craft. It could have been uncovered by the Millennial Consortium, or Erica could have traded for one before Tiamat's destruction.
Kane's eyes flickered momentarily at the scientist's suggestions, but he didn't relax.
Thanks for trying, Lakesh. For trying to make it seem less than it could be. But my job is to look for the worst-case scenario. Let's simply assume that one of those snake-faced bastards survived Tiamat, and he's making some moves. Come on, let's head to Ops. They're waiting for us.
It's your job to be prepared for the worst. It's my job to look at all possibilities equally. Both are important, and let us do what we do best. This is part of the synergy that has kept us going all this time.
Kane nodded grimly, slowing to accommodate his two companions, realizing the effort Lakesh expended to maintain his pace.
The only synergy I want is the blending of a bullet and an Anunnaki face. I'd thought we were done with the fucking overlords.
The only one who died for certain was Lilitu. With our rogues gallery, unless you see the corpse, they truly cannot be discounted. And even then, some whose corpses we have beheld as forever stilled, Colonel Thrush, Enlil, Sindri...
Sindri was just beamed into a storage pattern. No corpse to behold, as you put it.
The three people entered the redoubt's ops center, where Bry, Bridget Baptiste, Grant, and Brewster Filboid were waiting. While Kane was an imposing figure, Grant was truly menacing. Taller than Kane, with a thick, powerful build, Grant was also a former magistrate. Bry and Bridget were at one of the computer workstations. Filboid and Grant were sitting at a desk, throwing cards down in a quick game of war. With Kane's entry, Grant seemed relieved, obviously tired of the card game.
Glad you finally showed up, Kane. Filboid's cheating.
Not again.
Grant, the game's called war. In a battle, do you fight fair?
Brewster, it's a card game. You're not supposed to cheat. What's the fun in that?
Now, this is hypothetical because I am not a cheater, but...
Yes, you are, and I know how you're doing it.
Takes one to know one.
Let us know when you two are finished.
Bridget glared with chilly disdain at Grant and Filboid, their minor quarrel finally breaking her concentration. Kane grinned and leaned in toward Grant, a conspiratorial gleam in his eye.
Busted. Besides, who else are you going to play cards with?
I don't know. I was thinking, my partner.
Maybe if I catch amnesia and forget how much of a hustler you are.
Kane looked at the monitor where Brian and Bridget were busy.
That's the contrail from the dropship.
Yes, but we can't tell who was piloting the dropship. It could be anyone who gained access to one of them. We spotted the transonic atmospheric distortions in the island chain that used to be Greece.
It has to be something important for the surviving overlords to risk exposure. As far as we knew, when Tiamat was destroyed, they all died.
Hard to believe that something as old and big as Tiamat could die. The big bitch might be down, but I don't think it's forever.
By the time she recovers from her injuries, we'll hopefully be long dead, preferably of old age.
Bridget took off her archivist glasses and rubbed her eyes a moment before pushing away the horrifying thought of Tiamat, the miles-long living chariot of the gods, reawakened to spread more destruction. The starship had more than enough power to scour all life from the surface of the planet. Its crippled and comatose state had accounted for lessened stress in her life, though the thought of an active Anunnaki overlord was hardly reassuring. Bry's fingers danced over the keyboard, and a bird's-eye view flashed on the monitor.
Right now we're looking at some footage recorded from a recent conflict in that region. The footage is about 20 minutes old, and we only caught the tail end of things.
The monitor's image sharpened until Kane and Lakesh could see the presence of massive sets of coppery metallic heads and shoulders, like living statues, leaving behind a morass of green and black corpses.
I've double-checked the math, and the dead creatures are about a shade over 5 feet tall, and they're identical, at this magnification at least. They resemble the humanoid reptilian mutants that used to roam across the remnants of the United States.
Scalies? But they were exterminated.
Here on the North American continent, Lakesh. But remember that these mutants can be artificially created.
Friend Bry, if they're about 5 feet tall, then how big are those constructs walking away?
Approximately 12 to 15 feet, and almost half as wide. What did you call them, Bridget?
Mechanoids, or the abbreviation, Mecha. Generic terms for robotic combat vehicles.
Giant robots. Larger than the ones we encountered in China. And heavily armed by the looks of them. What else have you determined, Mr. Bry?
Close-ups of the shoulders correlate with late 20th century machine gun designs. Belt-fed rifle caliber. Grant recognized them, and using the known dimensions of the weaponry, calculating the rest of the robot size was easy.
Bridget wants to meet with the group that owns the robots. They seem fairly decent, according to this footage.
Decent? That's a refreshing change. How did you determine that, Bridget?
We caught a flash of an explosion while scanning the area. On image enhancements, we saw that a trio of robots was assisting a line of local villagers against the mutants.
Bry queued up the silent footage, and Lakesh watched the battle from above. He was surprised to see one of the mechanoids detonate an explosion at its own feet to staunch the tide of attackers. He was even more dazzled when the chest plate of the robot swung open. He couldn't see inside the torso of the robot, but apparently there was someone inside. Kane leaned forward.
It looks like one robot is talking to the others about the friendly fire incident at the start of the recording.
So, they're piloted craft, and they have rules of engagement to protect outlying communities.
There seems to be a lack of industrial capability in the town. If they have only bolt-action rifles and pitchforks to deal with the mutant horde, I doubt that those people have a garage to tighten the nuts on a battle robot.
Precisely, friend Kane. Indeed, there aren't even any vehicles on the premises.
I am fairly curious, but Bry and I have been running comparisons with the one prone mechanoid being dragged back to base. Any pilot taller than 5 feet would be cramped inside even the most generous of compartments for the robots. Domi is well over the limit for riding inside the chest, let alone operating the device. Don't you think so, Domi?
Yeah. Maybe Sindri's people are there?
Yeah, the transadapts. The tallest of them were just over 4 feet. And if you have a lab that can breed scalies, you can whip up a batch of transadapts as well.
Trouble is, those strange little monkey men would be in conflict with the critters from the selfsame lab. And the transadapts we've encountered are hardly friendly and generous toward humans.
Grant, you're also talking about an abandoned people who had been slaves. Not being oppressed and forced into submission to humans would have had a good effect on them.
Genes don't always make people rotten. Remember Quavel?
The team glanced at each other, their eyes solemn, as each of the Cerberus staff present remembered the Quad-V hybrid who had taken refuge with them for several months while she was pregnant. The Cerberus explorers had initially believed that the infant had been sired by Kane when he had been captured and pressed into stud service to revitalize the frail, genetically stagnant hybrids. When it turned out that someone else had fathered the child, Kane and his allies continued to protect Quavel and her baby. Quavel died, however, due to complications of childbirth brought on by the genetic transformation from the slender, delicate hybrids to the larger, more powerful Nephilim, the servants of the Anunnaki overlords, who had also been awakened by Tiamat's signal. Especially present in the minds of those around Domi was the albino girl's shift from hatred and loathing of the pan-terrestrial humanoids to love and compassion for the hybrid woman. Domi shook the reverie off and ran fingers through her snowy hair.
What's powering the robots? Doesn't look like there's any, exhaust smoke like a sandcat.
Kane, you remember the Atlantean outpost that Quail had discovered?
Yeah, you missed out on that. I'm sure you would have loved the place. All kinds of wall carvings and a metal called orichalcum that blew up when sunlight touched it. Took out the whole joint.
Greek philosophers like Plato and Pliny discussed Atlantis at length. One of the things mentioned was the legendary gold-copper alloy that was the hallmark of Atlantean society. Seeing it as a staple of decorations and animatronic statues in city plazas seems at odds with the unstable explosive compound you described.
Fan told me what the stuff was called. Besides, the outpost was a couple of thousand years old and under the ocean. Who can say that the seawater exposure didn't rust it or cause some kind of other imbalance? Like dynamite left sitting too long? Maybe kept away from rust-inducing salty humidity, it's great.
You stated that it was stored in a vault, under excellent storage conditions. However, it could be akin to a high-energy metal like uranium. I wish you'd brought back a sample.
Quail kept me kind of busy for that. Plus, the whole sunlight making it go off like a grenade thing dissuaded me.
In its stable format, orichalcum could easily prove to be a reliable power source. Given Grecian familiarity with Atlantean mythology, it's quite possible that these robots may be artifacts from an outpost placed in Greece. Or it could be a component of a highly durable alloy. What's your opinion, Lakesh?
Given the artifacts we've found around the world, it's very possible that Atlantis itself was the beneficiary of Anunnaki and Twahadidanon technology. The orichalcum that Cain discovered could be a manufactured element along the lines of plutonium. But the most important thing is that they have apparently mastered a lost form of technology. We had a glimpse of it with Wei Kiang at the Tomb of the Three Sovereigns.
Grant nodded at the image on the monitor of lifeless, scaled mutants and their shattered muskets being shoveled into a mass grave.
Those suckers were strong, but still only man size. Basically, semi-intelligent muscle. Double their size and give them a thinking person at the controls, you've got some considerable power on your side. I wondered how those robots did what they did. I mean, programming-wise. They reacted to our actions with some reasonable responses.
Ancient forms of computers have been discovered. The most prominent of these is the Antikytheria mechanism. The Antikytheria was an analog gear-style computer that was capable of charting star patterns. It's a fairly simple-looking design, and more minute versions of that gear, working in concert, could form a non-circuit board-style computer.
Fred Brewster, didn't Archytas also mention that he possessed an automated, steam-powered wooden robot pigeon?
Around 200 BC. It was capable of flight, if I recall correctly.
So they could have airborne mechanoids.
Potentially, but I presume that it would simply be more efficient to hang one off the bottom of a death bird. I'd consider a manta, but the damaged armor appears ill-suited for orbital use. Also, these are 15 feet tall. Plenty big, but not as big as some of the monstrosities in myths like Talos or the Colossus of Rhodes.
How big would those be?
Descriptions are inconsistent, and they could have been highly embellished as mythology advanced. Talos could reasonably have been about 40 to 60 feet tall, and the Colossus about twice that.
Domi shot a thoughtful look at the vidscreen, showing the robot lying on its back.
Well, it's nice to know that we have friendly folks in control of that technology. I can see why we'd want to hook up with them right away. You see what I saw, Grant?
Yeah, the Greek robot pilots can fight, and they have an advanced form of technology. It'd be like the tigers of heaven had our mantas from the start. If the snake faces are back and in action, we can use that kind of fighting power.
Which explains the presence of a dropship in the region. The Greeks represent a possible enemy, and the overlords don't want to have to deal with them.
You're right. We'd better assemble an away team to meet them, especially if they can be potential allies.
With a heads up, we could make invaluable friends. What could go wrong?
Philboyd paled, remembering the conflict with McCann, a Twaha prince, that had been sparked when the Outlanders visited the Menetius moon base for the first time. Grant and Kane looked at each other.
Suit up.
I'm coming too.
We might need backup from Cad Beta.
Then I'll be on scene. If necessary, the rest of my team will come too. One of the X-Mags can substitute for me in the meantime.
Time to break out the battle bra again.
Hera stood at the head of the table. Zu, Eri, Polly, and the rest were arranged around a bisected corpse illuminated by a searing white cone of light. The separated torso had been selectively burned. Cauterized wounds from Eri's thermal axe had sealed in the dead thing's juices behind walls of charred flesh. The face had been cleaned up, and it was at once handsome and intimidating. Though finely sculpted, the face's beauty was sheathed in fine-scaled, lizard-like armor. Diana tried to shake off her imaginings of this creature's angelic magnetism, even in its sleep of oblivion. She had to remind herself that this being had been fighting alongside the Tartarus mutants, joining them in a raid on a new Olympian settlement. The mutants were mass murderers, bred for attacking and exterminating humans. The wake of death and terror that Thanatos' minions had left was something that Diana would never forget. Absently, she touched her fused, fire-scarred cheek. The handsome snake-like humanoids that were related to the lifeless thing under the blazing light were allied with the monsters that inspired Diana to sacrifice her remaining leg so that she could fit into the cockpit of a hero suit. The orichalcum-framed battle suits had been designed around slighter, smaller creatures. As such, even a small woman like Diana had been before the Tartarus raids had scarred and mutilated her was too large for the cockpit. The metal caps on her thigh stumps and the cybernetic port adjacent to her lower spine were less a reminder of her wounds than they were badges of her empowerment. No matter how beautiful the stranger was, the ugliness of his allegiance to the enemy was unmistakable. Zeus, the chief of the Pantheon, looked at her. His furry features made his nickname of Zu all too appropriate.
Recognize what the creature is wearing, or are you still caught up looking into his eyes?
Diana bit back a response as she examined the burnished metal sheathing of the corpse's limbs and torso.
Secondary orichalcum. The color's a bit off, but he's clothed in it.
It's more than just that. It's woven, nearly cloth-like, and far more flexible than anything we've ever seen, except for the suit Hera wears.
Eri's axe carved through it, but we're talking about a blade swung by a 1.5-ton war machine. You can see the discoloration there and there where our small arm struck it. Bullets penetrated its limbs only on straight hits. Anything less turned into a glancing blow.
Hera looked at the bisected stranger, her silvery fingertips touching as her mind seemed to be caught up in a storm. She wrapped her metal-clad knuckle on the inert body's thigh.
Someone not only knows how to mass-produce secondary orichalcum, but has enough to give it out like clothing.
How do you get in that, m'lady Hera? It's not like that getup's got a zipper.
In a way, there is.
Hera rolled over the top of the torso, revealing a knot-shaped mechanism high between the stranger visitor's shoulder blades. None of the 11 pilots of the Pantheon needed to be reminded of the similarity between the device and the one that enabled their goddess queen to enjoy the protection of impenetrable silver and gold skin. The same knotted base for ropes of molded smart armor was a cybernetic port that Hera had been able to reverse engineer in order to allow the pilots to control their robotic warsuits. Hera fiddled with the device until bands of metal retracted, folding back into a capsule around the cybernetic hub. The metal had only peeled away from the torso and arms, the lower part of the corpse still clad in its glimmering armor. Zu wheeled over as Hera pried the mechanism from the back of the corpse.
Almost an exact match.
Zu reached out with his burly arm and picked up the severed forelimb, still wearing its glove of secondary orichalcum armor. Around the wrist of the grisly trophy, three tendrils of mechanical cable ended in snake-like heads.
Though apparently it still maintains its shape without the proper command impulse.
Careful with that, Zu. When I went after him, he fired a burst of energy from the device still on his wrist. It had enough power to smash one of my axes. It was like nothing I'd ever seen. It's a lot more focused than Polly's Greek fire sprayers.
Hera plucked the blaster-equipped wrist from Zu's grasp. She seemed to be weighing it against the cyber module in her other hand.
So what is all of this? What has you so nervous?
I want this technology, Diana. I want all of this. If we had this kind of weaponry, we could drive Thanatos and his mutants into the ocean. If these become common among the spawn of Tartarus, we'll be swept from the Earth.
Give me half dozen Spartans and I'll run a reconnaissance. A quick raid and we'll see if this was the only one or if there are more.
No.
But
do not make me repeat myself, girl.
The wheelchair bound pilots all sat very still. They had never seen their goddess queen this agitated in the years that they had known her. Most of all, they had never imagined that Hera would have growled a threat at any of them, let alone Diana, the girl who was Hera's surrogate daughter. The menace hanging in the air, however, was unmistakable.
Zhu, come on. I'm taking this back to my lab.
The queen and her amputee consort left the conference room without another word. Diana watched, feeling a knot of nausea tightening in her gut. The goddess who had raised her up from a useless cripple had delivered her to a rebuke before her peers. After all she had done for the Pantheon, earning herself a role as named pilot of a hero suit with blood and sacrifice, Diana stung as if she were discarded, tossed aside like a petulant child. Harry wheeled over to her, affection warming his deep brown eyes as he studied her fused mask of a half-face.
Die, baby.
Just leave me alone. I'm too old to need babysitting.
Harry swallowed, regretting his choice of words. The high-tech war avatar pilot made no secret of his love for the straw-haired girl who commanded the robotic huntress, even though Diana had cut herself off from interpersonal ties, feeling herself unworthy of romance. He reached out to take her delicate fingers in his grasp.
Dai, something is worrying Hera. Otherwise, she wouldn't be so on edge. I mean, there's a fucking alien lying on the table and he had a laser gun and bulletproof armor. Look at it.
I have been. It's almost human, though. An alien should be alien, shouldn't it? Think about it. Two eyes, two ears, vestigial as they are. Nose, mouth, arms, legs. This could be something out of those cheesy old vids about the starship, where they distinguished aliens from humans by putting bumps on their forehead or some rubbery makeup.
Yeah, this is a lot more convincing than latex. It looks like the big brother of the Hydri Horde. The one that got all the good genes, while the others are just crappy copies.
Holly wheeled closer, eyeing the angelic reptilian for a minute before glancing at Ari and Diana.
That's why Hera's so scared? You think this critter is the one who supplied the template for Thanatos' clones?
It's possible. Look, I need some space. See you guys later.
Diana turned and wheeled herself away from the concerned looks. All she could think about was Hera's bitter rebuke. With her friends behind her and only the dim corridor ahead, she finally allowed silent tears to slip down her cheeks. The interphaser sound faded in Kane's ears, and the energy plasma dissipated around him. His keen point man's instincts kicked in, sweeping the area where they'd emerged. The sky blazed a burned orange, marking the sunset over the mountaintop ruin. Kane could smell the brine of the ocean, the Aegean, he'd learned from Brigid. He set down his war bag and jogged to the edge of the weathered and cracked stone floor. Behind him, Brigid, Grant, and Domi set about stowing their own equipment bags. Grant made certain to secure his huge rifle case. The container was taller than Domi, but there was a crack in the stone floor large enough to hide it in. Domi paused to see Grant setting aside his and Kane's weapons, which they were clearly going to take, while Brigid packed hers away.
Brigid, why are we leaving our copperheads here? But Kane and Grant are taking theirs. Can I even have my grenades?
This is a first contact mission, and it requires some diplomacy. If we all have large weapons, it would send the wrong message. You've still got your detonics.
Yeah, but how about if you and me keep our big guns, and the boys can do the sweet talking?
Grant rolled his eyes as he worked. Grenades and Grant's monster-sized Barrett rifle were stashed away for contingency in the event of betrayal and disarmament. The extra weaponry disappeared under a camouflaging tarpaulin that Grant covered with dirt. Kane pulled a pair of compact field glasses from a pouch on his equipment belt and slung it over his shadow suit and scanned the area.
No movement.
Kane lowered the glasses and turned to see Brigid Baptiste tracing her fingers over the surface of a weather-beaten column.
Any ideas what this was?
Considering that many of the vortices were recognized by ancient peoples as places of power, aided by the influence of the first folk, this could have been an oracle. This isn't Delphi, but it has a similar layout. Sadly, nothing of archaeological significance remains.
So you won't be distracted by shards of pottery?
No. The only thing that could be found here would be in the form of resonant psychic energy.
Oh, right.
Because the oracles were manned by ancient Psi-muties, the node's energy would increase their perceptions.
That's a very good theory. You've been doing some reading?
Continuing education. With all the crap we've encountered and all the telepathic trespassing that's gone on in my head, it helps to be prepared. Granted, I'm working off of digital copies of the Fortean Times in the Redoubt's library.
I remember when you asked for that archive disk. I thought it was just to get more information on Atlantis.
That's where it started. A lot of the theories in those old rags sounded crazy, but after slugging it out with Quail in the outpost, I had a feeling we'd eventually run across Atlantis itself. Along the way, other articles caught my eye, mainly from personal experience.
We know for a fact that the Anunnaki took roles of the Sumerian and Greek gods, among other identities. With that knowledge, some of Von Daniken's alien god theories come off much more plausibly, if you're willing to ignore the obvious sloppy interpretation of an Aztec sacrifice's guts being mistaken for the tube hookups on an ancient spacesuit.
Anyway, we seem to be on a peninsula. There's a land bridge leading down from that cliff. So far, I don't see any movement that would indicate the locals are aware of our presence.
Thank heaven for small favors.
Kane resumed scanning the countryside through the field glasses. Suddenly, a column of blue-white electrical fire speared down into the land, creating huge clouds of debris and smoke from the earth.
Whoa!
Kane recoiled from the power and the violence. At first, he thought it was a lightning bolt. But the searing slash of energy was too focused, too intense, and lasted far too long to be a simple work of nature. Flames licked up from charred ground, and sprawled in the scarred landscape, burned corpses steamed. The dying sunset had been blotted out, overwhelmed by the brilliance of the sky fire, and he could smell the sickly scent of roasting human flesh from the dead and dying people all around. He felt his shoulder grabbed. It was Grant. Kane blinked away the flashes, and the sights, sounds, and smells faded.
Kane?
The big ex-magistrate Sin Eater retracted back into its powered forearm holster. Though Grant appeared confused at what had caused Kane to stagger and reel.
No, of course you wouldn't have seen that. It wasn't real.
Domi watched him with real concern, not putting her handgun away.
See what? You froze for a moment, then started backing away from the edge.
The Oracle helped me experience a Psi-Muti vision.
What did you see?
Lightning. But it wasn't natural lightning. It was a weapon, and it tore the ground apart. And it was focused. It left swaths of charred corpses in its wake.
Zeus, the king of the Olympian gods, had a quiver of thunderbolts forged for him by Hephaestus. Zeus's thunderbolts were so powerful, they could destroy even the greatest monsters in the land. That myth could have its basis in an Anunnaki weapon.
This shit's getting weird.
You asked to come along. They could destroy monsters, other gods, cities too, right, Bridget?
Yes. Zeus obliterated anyone and anything with his thunderbolts.
So nothing in our bags is ever going to match that kind of firepower. Let's just head down the bridge and meet the locals before Zeus drops the sky on us.
Kane nodded in agreement. Finally past the harrowing realism of his momentary psychic flash.
Good plan.
The arcs of future lightning were still harshly inscribed on his mind's eye, an ominous premonition of hell peeling back the sky and incinerating the earth below. He couldn't dismiss his dread, and so he threw himself into his work. Maybe knowing the potential tragedy looming in the future gave Kane the power to prevent it. He decided it was as good a coping mechanism as any. The farther they got from the Oracle, across the ramp of stone and packed earth sloping down from the ancient temple's remains, Kane's senses grew clearer, returning to normal. As his senses sharpened, he realized that they were not alone. He shot a glance toward Domi, knowing that her own feral instincts were also preternaturally sharp. She was on edge. Grant picked up on his two allies' silent, brief exchange.
Where? Feels like we're surrounded, at least two flanks.
Grant nodded. The hilly rolling terrain was covered with sparse scrub, making it difficult for anyone to hide any closer than the hill crests that bracketed them. Only the tops of the ridges provided sufficient concealment, as well as a good commanding view of the rut they passed through. Even with the deepening shadow of evening, their stalkers would be behind the ridges. The massive ex-magistrate flipped down the faceplate on his black polycarbonate helmet, and vision-enhancing optics were engaged. While the shadow suits and mandibular implants had superseded most of Grant's old armor protection and communication functions, the image intensifying and night vision capabilities of the black helmets were too valuable to surrender. The mag helmet was also one of the few pieces of equipment that Grant was able to perform repairs on without compromising the fit of the magistrate armor piece. A heat source flared on a ridge, a head poking over the hilltop. Grant locked onto it, but the figure disappeared quickly. Still, he had enough for cursory identification.
Humanoid. Scrawny, hairless, and naked according to the signature. Mammalian core heat.
Naked? Then it's not the robots laying out this welcome mat.
More like the mutants we saw on satellite view. Strange that they have reptilian skin, but mammalian endothermic metabolisms.
Strongbow's old crew were scaly-faced as well, though they had remnants of facial hair.
Makes you wonder about the so-called scalies often referenced in the Wyeth Codex.
Less ancient history, more current events.
Kane pulled down his own faceplate, his point man's instinct working together with the advanced electronics of the magistrate helmet.
There is some historical relevance. Zeus's greatest enemy was the monster Tiamat, mother of a million tormenting beasts.
Tiamat is dead.
Our Tiamat is, but look at places like the Archuleta Mesa, or the attempted use of Area 51 to produce Quad V hybrids. Two locations that had the technological potential to create biological constructs. It stands to reason that if Greece is a location for Anunnaki-designed robots, there might also be the technology for creating monsters. Literally, the womb of Tiamat. The first folk are a prime example of Anunnaki genetic tampering.
So whoever played Zeus the first time long ago made his own rogues gallery?
Who knows? The towns in these islands are heavily fortified. That bespeaks an ever-present hostile enemy in herd-like numbers. Considering the corpses shoved into the mass grave and the amount of damage those poorly armed humanoids were able to inflict on a single robot, we must be dealing with some sort of cloning facility. So they'd be akin to the mutant herds that roamed the American wasteland after the war. Bred specifically to be alien, of animalistic intelligence and a hostility toward non-altered humans, they would be a perfect means of keeping the surviving population in check until the program of unification.
Can you think of a better way to isolate communities?
The 2X mags scanned the hilltops with their light amplification lenses. The ground was cast in an eerie green haze by the helmet units. Though Domi and Bridget didn't have the high-tech headgear, Domi's sensitive albino eyes were accustomed to the darkness, and Bridget was wearing a lightweight moon-based visor. Bridget's eyewear was slightly bulkier than a pair of sunglasses, but the lenses were polarized to allow protection against intense light sources, as well as having a built-in LED UV illuminator and lenses that filtered the tiny lamp into the visible spectrum, as well as amplifying ambient light. Still, the tall archivist envied the telescopic targeting option on Kane's and Grant's mag helmets.
So far, it only looks like we have one shadow.
It feels like more.
Kane looked at Domi. She nodded, then turned to go.
Be careful, girl.
The admonition brought a smile to the albino's face, a moment of cherubic warmth before her porcelain features hardened into a grim battle mask. In moments, she vanished into the dusk.
You know, they're going to wonder where she went.
Good. That'll force them to divide their focus. I'm going up ahead to further disperse them. Stay close to Grant.
Bridget looked as if she was going to protest, but held her tongue. There were times when the four Outlanders operated as a democracy, each applying individual skills and expertise to solving their mutual dilemmas. On the other hand, when being hunted by an unknown number of enemies in the countryside of a far-flung, shattered nation, Bridget would defer to Kane's warrior knowledge and hard contact experience. Her brief irritation was squelched by the insight that she and Grant would form the hinge of a two-flanked counterattack by Kane and Domi. Grant needed Bridget's backup as much as she needed him. Grant simply nodded at his partner, and Kane advanced 50 yards ahead of the pair. Kane wasn't certain if the mysterious stalkers had access to the same optic technology that he and his allies possessed, but he doubted it. The massive warbots would be more likely to possess advanced cameras, but their stealth would be negligible compared to the scrawny mutants that Grant had spotted. From the satellite pictures, they seemed to be more proficient at using their muskets and bayonets as spears rather than rifles, which meant the complexities of electronically enhanced vision would be beyond their limited mental scope. However, if the mutants had sharp, animalistic senses, Domi's transformation to shadowy midnight wraith would be insufficient camouflage. Even with her shadow suit already blended to the darkened terrain by fiber optic technology and the addition of a blackened head rag covering her bone-white hair and a scarf wrapped around her nose and jaw, the acute night vision of predatory animals would allow her to be spotted easily. He trusted her to stay alive. This far from the Oracle's influence, the minutes separating him from his jolting psychic flash, Cain trusted his instincts again, and he felt as if violence was about to break loose like a driving rain. He activated his contact.
Domi, eyes on targets?
10 muties close to you. Dozen back by others. Haven't seen me.
Cain seized his copperhead from its spot on his web belt.
Definitely muties.
Hunch, scrawny, bald, and ugly. They think they can sneak up on me.
Watch your ass. It feels like they're ready to make a move.
Cain froze. Before he could call out, something registered on his visor, an infrared trace in his peripheral vision.
Grant, on our left.
Just spotted that one. Looks like we're being herded. So the numbers that Domi announced are probably double. This could get her off.
So what else is new?
What happened?
You caught a glimpse of muties across the way.
We're going to be boxed in, and that's going to suck. Time for us to make some noise.
He transferred the copperhead to his left hand and flexed his forearm tendons. The sensitive actuators in the holster for his sin-eater launched the folding machine pistol into his grasp.
That got attention.
Cain raced broken field pattern toward the surge of infrared contacts on his left on the ridge across from Domi's position. His charge was met by a half-dozen misshapen heads popping up in response to rapid movement. They peered over the spine of the hill. A musket ball smacked wet and hot against Cain's chest, stopping his forward charge as if he'd slammed into a brick wall. Diana's dream started out exactly as before. Instead of the sterile, pristine surgical studio where Hera Olympiad conducted the amputation of her remaining leg, she was in a flame-lit cavern where the walls seemed carved from pulsating reptilian flesh. Shadows danced wildly behind the silver-clad goddess whose precision instruments had transformed into jagged, gore-encrusted saws and splinter-edged cleavers. Without administering an anesthetic, Hera hacked down violently.
Hera, no!
Her medical assistants had been replaced by hunchbacked, blue-scaled mutants from the Tartarus Horde. Rather than handing her the tools she needed to remove Diana's healthy leg in order to fit her inside the cockpit of the mechanical warsuit, their gnarled claws raked obscenely over her silver and gold curves, leering in delight at splatters of blood and wriggling pieces of flying flesh. Blue-black tongues stretched from between scaled lips to lap the offal off Hera's armored skin.
So tasty is our daughter. Ugly, tasty, and ours.
Diana craned her neck, trying to get a look at the speaker, but her attention was seized by the metal cap crushing her thigh stump. The vibrations tore through Diana's body, and she bit her lip in a fruitless attempt to keep from crying out again. A hammer whacked the steel stump cap. Hera frowned down at her.
Roll over.
Diana looked up to see a pulsing, gel-filled black creature with barbed and hooked beetle limbs twitching in Hera's grasp.
I need to put in your interface.
Diana nodded. It was the sacrifice she had to make to become powerful enough to fight off Thanatos' hordes. A reptilian hand caressed her cheek, scales rubbing like sandpaper on her remaining facial skin.
It will only hurt a moment, child.
Diana's eyes widened with horror as she recognized the speaker, the one who called her his daughter. It was Thanatos himself, the scale-skinned lord of Tartarus, present at her conversion from fragile flesh to armored warrior goddess. She tried to pull away, but the beetle limbs speared into her back, tearing through skin and anchoring in her muscles. A stinger of venomous fire plunged into her spine, and Diana froze in feverish agony. Thanatos let go of her face, freezing in his own horror. A hand wrapped around the Monster King's throat, and with a savage, cracking twist, Thanatos, his neck broken, collapsed in a jumble of useless limbs. Diana lay on the table, looking at the newcomer who had executed the demon lord of the Tartarus Horde. It was a tall, magnificent creature, even larger in stature than the corpse in the briefing room. Incredibly, its face was even more of a mix of angelic beauty and devilish intensity. Dark eyes looked down on the amputee, on the cracked stone that was the operating table, then dismissed her. It strode regally around the abattoir table, meeting Hera as an equal, wearing even more splendid skin armor than hers. A long, elegant claw stroked the armored woman's cheek.
It has been too long, lover.
I didn't know if you'd ever come for me.
Diana looked in disgust and betrayal as goddess, queen, and alien angel kissed passionately.
No!
Diana's eyes flew open as she fled from the hideous night terror. Her straw-like hair was matted to her sweaty forehead. She rolled to her side on the bed and sat up, gripping her chair. Cable-tight arm muscles tensed as she hauled her truncated body into its seat. She rolled to the nearby metal sink and turned on the faucet. Even splashes of cool water from the simple metal basin of her sink did little to ease the psychic burns seared into her mind. Grabbing a cloth, she dried her face, then rolled to the door. She rolled out of her quarters, making her way through the new Olympian complex. Diana needed the comfort of her cramped cockpit, the womb of steel that completed her being. Outside Artemis, Diana was only a husk, a leftover that wasn't really alive. In the massive mechanical warsuit, she became something much more. She was fully alive, not an animated piece of burned and fused meat. The hydraulic limbs, hooked into her central nervous system by the cyberport on her spine, felt as natural as if she had been born with them. Fast was in the hangar, gnawing on a cheroot cigar as he brought his mug over to a coffee maker on the table. He looked at Diana as she entered.
Can't sleep?
Is she ready to roll fast?
Diana steered her wheelchair toward the inert robotic figure standing in its coffin-like dock.
Jolly fucking good evening to you, too. Yeah, you can see the chest plate's been rearmored. I realigned the leg hydraulics.
Diana rolled up to the trapeze arm off to the side of the robot. Diana hauled herself up onto the rung, swinging around on the pivoting metal pole to deposit herself in the pilot's couch. It took only a moment for her to snap the interface plug into her spine port. As the charged energy modules that powered the mobile armor came to life, imparting vitality into the inert robotic limbs, Diana's body tingled from scalp to stump cap. It was like when her arm fell asleep and felt cold and prickly, but as the blood rushed back into the arm, warmth dispelled the numb incompletion. She was whole as her nervous system completed the circuit that activated the ancient technology cradling her. Diana Artemis tapped the trapeze boom out of the way, locking it back over the wheelchair. Red camera lenses glared hatefully down at the conveyance for a cripple. As the mechanical warsuit needed no refueling thanks to the CEM's functions, Diana Artemis didn't need to worry about wasting resources while on an unscheduled patrol. Ted looked up at her. She closed the helmet.
Barry and Dion have patrols out. Zoo's on the prowl by himself.
Any particular operation or just walkabouts?
No word on what Zoo is doing. He said it was private business. Ares and Dionysus have Spartan units with them. Want me to rouse a couple for you?
Nah, I got the radio to bring in Ares or Dion. I just need to clear my head and get some fresh air.
Well, just you remember. Hera said that you're not supposed to go on an end run into the Tartarus holdings.
I said I was going out for a walk, not out for a suicide.
Diana was glad that Artemis didn't have the ability to convey facial expressions, even with the cybernetic hookup between her and the robot.
Speaking of which, I didn't look. I've got replacement javelins.
You've got a full quiver, and 9 yards of ammo per shoulder gun.
Thanks, Fast. Sorry about being such a whiny bitch.
Fast glanced over to the wheelchair and nodded.
It's that thing, kid. Being stuck in that would make me grumpy, too.
Diana Artemis put her metal claw tips to where her lips would be if she were human, then bent them back, a robotic kiss blown. That brought a smile to the wrench monkey's bearded face. With a graceful pivot, the robotic huntress strode out of the maintenance garage through the massive hangar doors and out into the countryside. The gloom induced by fever dreams evaporated as Artemis walked into the bleak sunset.
time to reload. Outlanders is continued on the next CD.